From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. President Donald Trump on Monday night made his highly anticipated announcement of Judge Brett Kavanaugh as his new Supreme Court nominee to replace retiring Justice Anthony Kennedy. The 53-year-old federal appeals court judge was an aide to President George W. Bush, had a part in investigating President Bill Clinton, and is a staunch Republican who is connected to conservative organizations. His name was high on the list of 25 judges vetted by extremist anti-abortion groups that Trump promised to pick from in case of a Supreme Court vacancy. So who is Brett Kavanaugh, and which of our rights are at stake with his confirmation to the nation's highest court? Joining me to answer this question is Jessica Mason-Piclo. She is Vice President of Law and the Courts at Rewire.news. She's a writer and adjunct law professor in Boulder, Colorado, and is the former assistant director of the Health Law Clinic at Hamlin Law School in St. Paul, Minnesota, and former litigator. And she just published a new piece about Kavanaugh on Rewire.news. We had her on just about a week ago to discuss the potential nominees. Welcome back to the show, Jessica.
Thank you so much for having me back. It's such a pleasure.
So you had speculated that Trump might pick a woman to particularly undo the Roe versus Wade decision. And Amy Coney Barrett was, I believe, in the top three with Kavanaugh and Thomas Hardiman. And he ended up picking Kavanaugh instead on Monday night. Were you surprised?
No, not really. I mean, you know, as we had mentioned last time I was on your show, one hurdle that Trump would have to clear in order to pick Amy Coney Barrett is his own misogyny and appointing a woman. So I suppose if there is a future Supreme Court vacancy, which I think there probably will be with Justice Thomas retiring soon, we'll see. I suspect she will still be up there. And, you know, Kavanaugh had long been considered a front runner and is a conservative favorite for a Supreme Court appointment before Trump was even elected. So in many ways, he's not a surprise candidate. But, you know, I did suspect that there would have been an opportunity for Trump to be trolling, so to speak, a little bit in selecting Barrett. That said, I think even in selecting Kavanaugh, there is some of that signature Trump, I'm just going to say it, trolliness in it, because, you know, this Kavanaugh is a colleague of Merrick Garland's and is coming up from the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals and is very much in the sort of conservative makeup for the case that liberals had made for Garland. And so I think that there is, you know, still a bit of a swipe in the nomination even there.
Now, there are reports suggesting that and claiming that this whole act, this whole highly anticipated piece of reality TV that aired on Monday night was a scripted performance whose outcome was known right from the start by both Kennedy and Trump, because Kennedy had apparently made it essentially a condition of his retirement if Trump were to put Kavanaugh forward. Kavanaugh is someone who had clerked for Kennedy earlier. What do you make of this? And should this impact the way in which lawmakers set about confirming Kavanaugh?
Well, those are certainly very serious allegations floating around. And I know that NBC has some initial reporting out that suggests there was some conversations between Kennedy and the Trump team in terms of replacement and who would be acceptable and perhaps some assurances. And if that's the case, I would really love to see some more extensive in-depth reporting, because those are very serious questions that need to be answered, particularly when Kennedy is ruling on cases immediately impacting the administration. I'm thinking most significantly of the Muslim ban and his concurring opinion in that case, where he effectively just finger-waggled at the president and said, "I don't like what you're doing, but I'm not going to stop you anyway." So I think that those raise concerns. You know, that said, in many ways, Kennedy's retirement was not a surprise. He had sort of been broadcasting that for a while. And I think many of us who watched the court anticipated this was coming. And several of the names that had been circulating before that was becoming clearer were also Kennedy. Clerks, which in of itself is not anything to be a surprise. I mean, it's a very conservative pipeline to get to the Supreme Court to begin with. Even liberals and Democrats choose from a very, you know, elite, small, select pool of folks. But the reporting that's coming out about the wooing nature of getting Kennedy off the bench and building off that is something that I definitely think we need to be spending some more time and attention on, particularly during the confirmation hearings and process, which is where the next step goes.
Right. And I want to talk about that in a minute. But staying on this for a minute, Raj Shah, who was a White House spokesperson, was asked the question about coordination between Kennedy and Trump on CNN. And he basically said, I'm not going to read out private conversations that Justice Kennedy had with either members of the White House or the president. And Justice Kennedy can speak for himself. He basically didn't deny that that's what had happened. This is the kind of thing that happens in an aristocracy, not a democracy. I mean, you know, you shouldn't get to just pick your successor to the court. It's supposed to go through a process. It's supposed to be an independent appointment, right?
Absolutely. And, you know, I think what we've seen with the Trump administration in particular is a breaking of all of those norms. You are completely correct that, you know, there is a process involved in how a nominee should be picked and vetted. You know, Kavanaugh obviously has excellent credentials in terms of his resume and his experience and all of that. But the idea that there is a transactional nature in Kennedy's retirement is something that is very disturbing if it proves to be true. I think even if it turns out that, let's say, these were sort of broad level conversations, it's still upsetting because what it shows is that Kennedy himself was a partisan. That even, you know, if it is not a quid pro quo, for example, that he was having conversations and making sure that his replacement would be appointed by a Republican president in this particular time, with all of the scandal swirling around the administration. You know, we have had presidents in the past who have had Supreme Court justices have the opportunity to resign in the midst of scandal, and they did not. I'm thinking in particular of the Clinton years. And so Justice Kennedy really had an opportunity here to rise above the political fray, and instead he dove right down to the bottom of it.
The New York Times, I was very dismayed to see on Monday, literally within maybe an hour of Trump making the decision, published an opinion by a man named Akhil Reed Amar, a professor at Yale Law School, that was entitled "A Liberal's Case for Brett Kavanaugh," which to me indicated that Democrats and liberal you know, elites are already coming up with reasons for why they should support Brett Kavanaugh. He's being likened to Merrick Garland. It's almost as though Trump is just picking a Garland-like figure. What do you make of this?
Well, I mean, quite frankly, I saw someone respond to that op-ed that it was interesting to see the New York Times publish a recommendation letter from one of
right, that's what it reads
former
like.
Employees because or former professors, because that's exactly what it was. You know, Kavanaugh was a former student, and that's not disclosed in this in, you know, a very
he was a
fashion.
Student of the writer.
Yes. And so we saw this with, we saw this with the liberals' case for Neil Gorsuch, too, with Niall Katyal published theirs. And so the New York Times has, I believe, a trilogy going at this point in terms of a liberals' case for some terrible thing that the Trump administration is about to put forward. And I think it's an indictment, quite frankly, of the legal profession as a whole, because like Neil Gorsuch, I'm sure Brett Kavanaugh is a quite lovely individual as a colleague. I'm sure he is, you know, genteel and nice and you know, at least I would hope so. I know, you know, Justice Gorsuch is very affable, but that doesn't mean that they don't have dangerous ideas and that implementing them have very real consequences. And each one of those a liberal's case for, in this case, Brett Kavanaugh, completely ignores that people's lives are on the line in this nomination. When we're talking about what's at stake, this is not an abstract concept. When we're talking about rolling back reproductive rights, that means that people will be imprisoned. That means that people could die. And this is not a hypothetical. And so I think that there's some real irresponsible publishing going on there.
Hmm. Jessica, when we had spoken last, we were talking about the fact that abortion was basically a litmus test, and opposition to abortion had been a litmus test for every person on that list that Trump was choosing from. So what do we know about where Kavanaugh stands on the issue of a woman's right to an abortion and Roe versus Wade? His position on that, we hope, would be a point of contention from the Republican moderates Susan Collins and Lisa Murkowski.
Right. Well, Brett Kavanaugh is going to try and dance this line, and absolutely nobody should let him. He will give a answer that is effectively, I respect precedent. And in reality, what we see is him casting votes and writing opinions that shows that he does not actually respect precedent when it comes to abortion rights whatsoever. We have very specific examples of that. For example, we have the case of Garza v. Hargan. That's the undocumented minor who was in the Office of Refugee Resettlement's custody and control, and had Kavanaugh's opinion and his beliefs been allowed to completely take effect, then the government would be able to effectively block in every way somebody in their custody from accessing an abortion. And so that's not just that's not a principle that is limited to an undocumented minor. If we take Kavanaugh's logic, that's anybody within the federal government's custody and control. So that's everybody in, federal prison, for example, or other types of federal custody, and then trickle that down through the state. So, we have a very clear example right now of a live controversy where he has voted to block abortion rights. We also have his previous writings, and in particular, quoting Justice Rehnquist, who was a dissenting vote in abortion rights cases consistently, and saying that, he believes, as Rehnquist did, that many of these areas of privacy rights were concocted by the courts in terms of, you'll hear, judicial activism. So the idea that Kavanaugh is less dangerous on abortion rights than Amy Coney Barrett would have been is a delusion.
Jessica, what do you make of the breathtaking speed with which Kavanaugh's nomination was announced after Kennedy's retirement?
It really is something. And, I think it speaks to, in part, the focus that the conservative movement has in generally on capturing the federal judiciary for a lifetime. And they are well on their way to do that. We saw the president move similarly as quickly in nominating Neil Gorsuch. He was nominated on January 31st, just 2 weeks after the inauguration. And so we were 12 days from Kennedy's announcement when we had a nominee. And part of that is it shows that they've been prepped for this, right? They have a list of candidates. They know what they want to get from them and the issues that they are working through the federal courts and nominee and hopefully a confirmation from their perspective to shape those. But it also shows that, in terms of the administration and Republicans taking seriously their constitutional duty of advice and consent in the Senate, they're abdicating that if they plan on ramming through another nominee, particularly in the middle of a criminal investigation.
And right before the midterm elections, right? Congress returns from recess, I believe, is it October when they would take, or would be the earliest that they would take up the confirmation, merely a month before the midterm elections?
Absolutely, absolutely. And we may hear that that's important for the court to function, and we know that that's not true because Republicans made sure that the court functioned with only 8 justices for several months while they held up the Merrick Garland nomination, and the court functions just fine, frankly. So there's no procedural urgency to get Brett Kavanaugh confirmed.
And of course, it was Mitch McConnell under his leadership that Republicans removed the supermajority rule so that now all you need is a simple majority confirmation in the Senate. And so it's basically the Republicans' task to make all of this happen before the midterm elections because they could lose that very slim majority they now hold on the court. So it all remains to be seen whether Lisa Murkowski and Susan Collins are going to oppose Kavanaugh and whether all the Democrats are going to stand firm, because sadly they're not reliable, as they showed when the Gorsuch nomination came forward. Several Democrats voted with Republicans. If the Democratic Party wanted to be united, if there was enough of a grassroots uproar among progressives, is it possible, you think, that the Democrats could stand united along with Collins and Murkowski to stave off the confirmation vote until after the midterm elections?
I think there's a possibility, or at least the Judicial Crisis Network thinks there's a possibility, because they just launched a huge ad buy in those markets that have Democratic senators who would perhaps vote to confirm Brett Kavanaugh. I'm thinking of North Dakota. I'm thinking of Alabama. I'm thinking of West Virginia, for example. So they're putting money into those places to put pressure on those senators. And so, you know, that is a very real task. And I think, quite frankly, though, all of these questions, our job now is to make sure that we let elected officials know that this is a process that does not need to happen in weeks. You know, your point in terms of the midterm elections is absolutely right on the money, because what conservatives are going to do is use this as an opportunity to try and turn out the vote in what would historically have been a lower turnout election for them, right? Midterm elections generally have lower turnouts, and particularly lower turnout when for the party who is in the majority. And so that was the electoral field that Republicans were looking for. And I just want to say one point in terms of your, this is not the way that democracies should work. You know, we saw in terms of these rumored negotiations with Kennedy and Trump, and then we're seeing it now in terms of a handful of elected, you know, mostly old white men, if we're being completely honest, ramming through a nomination by a president who received a minority of the popular vote. So this is absolutely a tyranny of minority rule right now.
Now, on the issue of the midterm elections, so Republicans are, just to pick up on a point you made, it sounds like Republicans are going to use the confirmation process as an election campaign strategy to bring out the vote, to show their constituents, forget about the tax reform bill that is hurting you, forget about the fact that the economy is still not working for you, forget about everything else. We're going to have a permanent conservative majority on the Supreme Court, therefore show up and vote for us.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, we are seeing this reporting trickle out from places like the Washington Post and the New York Times about the president's trade war impacting his most reliable voting blocks. And there is absolutely no way that conservatives are not seeing as this is an opportunity to change the conversation.
And as far as you know, aside from the issue of abortion, because that may not be the central issue to many people, you know, there may be people willing to throw women under the bus, let's put it this way. But he is also, Kavanaugh's position on workers' rights, on the environment and conservation issues, on LGBTQ rights are also pretty concerning, aren't they? And I don't know if there's any of those issues that you could expand on, or anything that you know about his background on the myriad other issues that are important to Americans.
Sure. So let's just take corporate power and corporate interest right now. According to Brett Kavanaugh, the Consumer Finance Protection Bureau, this benign government agency that was created under the Obama administration to make sure that your lenders can't lie to you in your loan applications, or that they can't make money against your interest, right? So those kinds of self-dealing things. According to Brett Kavanaugh, the CFPB is unconstitutional. So he completely votes for corporate power whenever given the opportunity. Another excellent example is gun rights. According to Brett Kavanaugh, the Second Amendment protects your right to conceal carry a semi-automatic weapon. I don't know how you would do that in public, but you know, I mean, let me put that in some context for the audience. Brett Kavanaugh. Kavanaugh's views on gun rights are more extreme than Justice Scalia's. And Justice Scalia is often heralded by the Second Amendment folks as the standard bearer. And Brett Kavanaugh would go further than Scalia.
So this is an issue that only seems to come up when there is a mass shooting. And all we hear, of course, from Republicans are thoughts and prayers. What do you think needs to happen? It feels from the grassroots, it feels Americans might be feeling helpless right now, right? Progressives, liberals, people who care about the myriad issues that are at stake for Kavanaugh's lifetime, essentially. What are recourses that the public can take? I'm assuming contacting their state senator and insisting that they stand firm against confirmation.
Absolutely. So, you know, really putting pressure on your elected officials. And then also, and I consider these parallel tracks. I think it's well past time that liberals and progressives started paying attention to what's going on in their state courts and in their state houses as well. Because in the event that we do get a bad ruling on Roe v. Wade, abortion rights, or marriage equality, we will be seeing several issues getting kicked back to the states. And so it's weird to be on the left and saying, you know, look at states' rights. Rights issues, but in terms of putting money and shoring up a plan B, so to speak, making sure your state has good protections for civil rights is an excellent area to be putting resources into.
And it's so sad because during these elections where we're asked to pick judges, local judges, statewide judges, there's so little information out there. Most people don't do much research. They might just vote for the incumbent or for nobody at all. And it's almost, it seems by design that these elections are so under the radar. There's very little campaigning. There's very little information out there. So people generally tend to sit them out.
Yeah, and you are absolutely right. And with the advent of the ability for PACs to spend on judicial races too, what we're seeing is that they're becoming more politicized as well. And that has very, very real ramifications for just the health and functioning of our democracy in general.
And finally, Jessica, given the things that have come out about coordination between Trump and Kennedy, are there any recourses that you know of in the sort of legal sense? I mean, you know, could organizations file a lawsuit saying that this coordination is illegal? Or I'm wondering if you know of any efforts to try to, you know, to essentially say we can't rely on just the Senate. We're going to try another route, because this single Supreme Court nomination is a make or break incident that would have ramifications on all America. It's basically it's something that could change the course of history in the U.S.
Absolutely. I mean, I certainly would hope that there are advocacy organizations who have drafted, if not already filed, FOIA requests on communications to see what exactly was being said by whom and when and where and in what context. That is very important. In terms of specific legal claims or pathways through the courts to block this nomination, we are not there yet. I think I saw something in The Hill about, you know, trying to launch a lawsuit based on the McConnell rule. And, you know, while I would love for that to be the case, I just don't see that as a viable legal pathway for a lot of reasons. But I do think that what we have is enough to start or to be asking more detailed questions. And this is an area where the audience can help, you know, raise these questions with your elected officials. Say, I want to know as a constituent what was going on here. We have a right to this information.
Jessica, rewire.news is the best place to read your writings?
Absolutely, yes.
We'll post a link to your latest article from our website. Thanks so much, Jessica.
Thank you so much for having me back.
Jessica Mason-Piclow is Vice President of Law and the Courts at Rewire.news, a writer and adjunct law professor in Boulder, Colorado, former Assistant Director of the Health Law Clinic at Hamlin Law School in St. Paul, Minnesota, and former litigator. We've been discussing Trump's Supreme Court pick, Brett Kavanaugh. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Also find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, and Vimeo. Thank you so much. Really appreciate